Okay, folks, welcome to the latest edition, the latest chapter, the latest exciting ramblings and romancings of life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, how are we this fine day? And this is our first podcast of autumn. You know, autumn came upon us at the end of last week. And now the thing is, Leslie Ann, that I can't say what I normally say is how much I love to see the leaves tumbling out of the trees, because a lot of them have already tumbled.
Been doing that for months, haven't they? It does feel as though somebody switched the weather off, because one minute I was still rushing about, sweating like mad, and wishing the heat would go away, and it felt very oppressive. Yeah. And then suddenly the cool breezes seemed to be blowing in, and almost as though autumn was announcing its own arrival. It was very strange.
No, do you know what? I had at the end of last week, I was in town both days at the end of last week and over the weekend. And again, you know, the heat problem and all that. And then you're absolutely right. I think it was like two nights ago. I have all the windows open. I've got Velux windows. So I open them at night before I go to bed to let what breeze in that there is, although there's no breeze in the heat. And all of a sudden, I felt chilly. I felt a chill wind blowing through the house, and I thought, it's here, it's autumn. And of course,
do you do what I do? Do you take, during the summer months, do you take the duvet off the bed and just have the duvet cover as a kind of double sheet?
No, I can't do that. I've got to have something to sort of grab onto, if you see what I mean. So
I beg your pardon.
Yes,
well, it's a family show.
It's a family show. But, you know, what I mean is I can't sleep with just a sheet over me or nothing over me at all. I've got to have something that, I mean, I don't have the duvet over me, but I kind of roll on top of it, if you see what I mean, you know, because
this is getting very personal. I think we need to move on, yes.
I think we should move on, indeed.
But all I was about to say was I have actually put the duvet back in the bag.
Right, okay.
So it's back on the bed. So I'm now tucked up at night.
Oh, excellent.
Just in case you were wondering.
Yeah, I am wondering indeed, Miss Jones. Thank you very much indeed. Do you get your duvets cleaned in the summer, by the way?
Yeah, I do. I take them off to the dry cleaner and they come back in a nice little blue kind of bag.
Yeah.
You know that stuff that J-cloths are made
yes,
of?
Yes, that's right.
It's
yeah.
Kind of like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
With a little carrying handle, so you just trot home with that.
Yeah,
but it makes them quite easy to store, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but I buy a new one every year now. I've decided it's a stage of life where, you know, I should get a new one every year. But anyway, there we are. I dread to think how long I've had one of the mattresses on one of my beds, but I think it must be, I think it's more than 12 years, and I'm not sure how often you're supposed to change your mattress, are you?
Well, I had a conversation with my friend Phil. He's a GP about this.
All right.
He's a GP with his own practice, and he kind of knows stuff, you know. And he pointed out that the only people who benefit from changing one's mattress every 8 to 10 years, which is what they recommend, he said this is just about mattress manufacturers.
Right.
He said there is no disadvantage to keeping modern mattresses for a whole lifetime.
Good God.
Because they talk about house dust mites breeding in mattresses and so on. But house dust mites breed absolutely everywhere, including in your eyelashes. And they are just a fact of life.
Right.
They feed on human skin and sweat, perspiration, that kind of thing.
Mm.
They just exist. They are creatures who are part of our existence, our lives.
Yeah.
And there used to be a trend to buy a special vacuum cleaner to clean one's mattress, you know, every sort of 2-3 months or so, just to get rid of house dust mites. They were a complete fallacy, and they went out of fashion. You can't find them in the shops anymore.
Ooh.
Because I think people realised this was just an added expense, and actually you can't eradicate house dust mites. They just are.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm so glad you've imparted all that information into me, because I often think, really, I'm behind the eight ball there, and I should get a new mattress. But
no, you're not. If your mattress is comfortable, stick with it.
Well, it was very expensive in the first place, and it has a cover on it. You know what I mean? One of those covers which is like spongy on the top and netting down the side. And then there are two sheets.
Well, that sounds quite radical, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And I make my housekeeper, you know, hoover the mattress in the way you said, but not with any special cleaner. She just takes the end off the nozzle of the I bought one of these handheld vacuum cleaners. It's called a Halo or something, and it charges itself, right, and you just walk around with it. But you can make the extension any length you want. Sorry, this is a family show, isn't it? Yeah. and therefore you can probably when you're a little kid.
Are you digging yourself in here?
No, I'm not. When you're a little kid, you might have helped your dad clean his car by getting one of those silly little hoovers and hoovering the inside of the car. You know what I mean? And it ends up like that. And she's been doing that for years, but I might have to tell her now not to bother. But anyway,
you can get a spray as well from Marks and Spencer, which is an antibacterial spray for fabrics and household kind of stuff. Yeah. And what I do is I just spray my mattress down with that once a week when I change the sheets.
Oh, really?
And you used to get that. This is going to get disgusting. Do you remember that horrible, I call it a head smell? Say you check into a hotel and the pillows sometimes smell of other people's rancid heads.
Well,
do you know that smell?
They used to. God, yeah.
So it just kind of eradicates all that staleness.
Indeed.
And it gives your pillows and your bedding a lovely fresh smell. You ought to try that.
Yeah, well, I might. I just think that if you're ever spraying stuff on fabrics and there's an advert on the TV which says, oh, if your room smells a bit musty, just come and spray your couch and your chairs with this spray. Sorry, you're just hiding the problem there. What your chairs and couch needs are clean.
Not if it's an antibacterial spray. It will get rid of the bacteria, which is what causes the smell in the first place.
Which department would they be in then, that sort of spray?
Just, where you buy things like washing powder, washing up liquid, that kind of thing.
You don't get those Marks and Spencer's.
Yeah.
Close all the food hall.
No. It's in the food hall department.
Oh, I see.
But there are shelves where you can buy household cleaning products.
Right, okay. Well, that's good to know. Now, listen, it's strange that you moved on to talking about supermarkets and all that because, I keep a close eye on the business pages of all the newspapers I read because I want to make sure that what little money I've got is safely invested and nobody's going to nick it or take it off me. And I read the other day that one prediction is that within 5 years, maybe, in 10 years, almost certainly, Aldi and Lidl, which are both German supermarkets and came to this country as very cheap budget supermarkets against the established supermarkets we have here, may well have overtaken within a decade Tesco and Waitrose. Now, that might be the case. And maybe, certainly we're going to go through hard times soon and, living costs are going to escalate because of energy and all that. But I've never been tempted into a Lidl or Aldi supermarket, even though there's one not 400 or 500 yards from me at one of the places I live. So I didn't know they were that popular.
Well, you need to get some enlightenment, Mike. I shop in Aldi all the time.
Right.
Actually, I call it Aldi, usually. Aldi.
Yeah.
I shop there all the time. And my grocery bill is about a third of what it used to be.
Really?
And if ever I need goodies for, say, I'm giving a dinner party or something like that, I might take a trip to your Marks and Spencer or even occasionally a Waitrose. But the drop in cost is so dramatic.
Really?
They may not have certain things that you have to go hunting for if you want something special that's not in there.
Yeah.
But the quality of the produce, so the fruit, vegetables, the salads and so on, is perfect.
Yeah.
The meat is very good. And cereals, milks, I use oat milk, as you know.
Yeah.
All those things are available in Aldi and they're top-notch quality. I think everybody needs to drop their snobbery about budget supermarkets and get down there and save some money.
Well, the first time I went in there, I looked for the bird's eye fish fingers because fish fingers are a very important part of my diet, okay? And they didn't have any. They had like some kind of German fish finger. And I think even the packaging was in German. And I thought, hang on, I don't know what I'm buying here. I'm not having this. And I left and I've never been back.
So you haven't tried the actual fish fingers that they do?
No.
So can I suggest that you give them a try? What have you got to lose?
Well, yeah, maybe. I think everybody's going to go that way, aren't they? If you're saying that you reduce your food bill by a third, by two thirds, everybody's going to be tempted. But surely people like Tesco and Waitrose have got to do something to try and keep up, haven't they? Because otherwise they'll just go out of business.
you've always got a level of people who are cushioned by wealth, who don't care about stuff like that. You know, certainly when my son was at Dulwich College, and it was a very sort of entitled, privileged world in which people don't worry about the fact that there's another £4 on their favourite brand of gin. You know, £4 is neither here nor there to them. But £4 to some people is a pullover for their child to go to school.
You're absolutely right. Right, that's very interesting. I my favourite supermarket has always been Tesco's. A, because I think they're very good. B, because I love the success story of Jack Cohen, who built them. It was called Tesco's because he was Jack Cohen, that's C-O-H-E-N. He had three children whose initials were T, E and S, so he called it Tesco. Isn't that amazing?
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. He had three children, you know, supposing they were called Timothy, Edna and Stuart.
Edna?
Well, you know, Eileen.
Imagine being called Edna Cohen.
Edna Cohen, yeah, that's right, yeah.
No thanks.
Or Eileen or something like that and Stuart. And he just put them together. That's how Lord Sugar came up with Amstrad, because AMS Trad, right?
Wasn't it Alan Michael Sugar or something?
Well
trading?
Well done, absolutely right. Alan Michael Sugar Trading, Amstrad. So it's amazing the way people get these names. No, but
which begs the question, how did Waitrose come about?
Well, no idea.
Is it the two words, Waitrose?
It must have been. Maybe the guy who founded it had to say to his mistress all the time, Waitrose, you know, a bit like...
I'm coming. Yeah.
No, a bit like...
it's a family show, stop it.
No, a bit like Napoleon, you know, not tonight, Josephine, whatever, Waitrose. I bet you that's it, you know. I bet he had a mistress called Rose, and he shouted out of the window to her because she was going to say, Waitrose. And when his wife said, what are you doing? Who are you talking to? No, I'm just trying out new names for my new supermarket. Waitrose.
Getting carried away.
Yeah, brilliant idea. Anyway, but to get back to the Tesco situation, so then I read that Tesco took in £1 out of every £7 spent in the high street. Okay, at their peak, when they were easily the biggest retailer in this country, £1 in £7 that people spent in the high street in this country was spent in a Tesco store. They opened all sorts of mega Tesco stores and all that. Then, very fortuitously, I got to meet Sir Terry Leahy. And Sir Terry Leahy was the chief executive of Tesco's, who made them brilliant. He invented the Tesco club card, and that was an absolute winner, you know, and they got into it years before all the other supermarkets and that sort of stuff. But I met Sir Terence Leahy in the director's box at Everton Football Club, because he's a Scouser, well, very sophisticated, Merseysider, and an Everton fan. And I was there once, and lo and behold, there I was sitting next to Sir Terence Leahy, the man who really made Tesco. So I don't want to see Tesco go down the tubes, though I read recently that they now take only £1 in £22 of all spending in the high street. And that is down, of course, to competition from people like Aldi and Lidl. You don't worry that they're German then?
Not at all. Why would I worry about that?
No, I agree. It's competition. I'm all...
It's a long time ago. It's post-war, you know, when they first started to infiltrate, as it were, the UK, the US and so on.
Really?
It's a long time ago, yeah.
I only heard about them in the last 3 or 4 years.
No, they've been around for donkey's years. I watched a documentary about them, which was absolutely fascinating, started by two brothers.
Yeah.
And they started as just a little high street grocery store.
Yeah.
And their trading ethos was always to undercut the competition.
Right, brilliant.
And then they went their separate ways. And I think, I remember, it was to do with one of the brothers wanted to carry on selling cigarettes and the other one didn't. So they divided up the company.
Wow, what a brilliant story. That's a bit like in Germany, Adidas and Nike, I think it is, or it might be Adidas and Puma, I can't remember. But at one stage, it was all run by the same family, and they split up and started two of the biggest, you know, sort of sports goods companies in the world. But look, enough of retail trading and all that.
May I just ask, before we depart this subject, Would you have an objection, for example, to driving a German car?
No, of course not. No.
So why would you object to shopping in a German supermarket?
No, I don't. Believe me, I'm a capitalist. I believe in free markets and I don't believe in barriers on trade and all that. All I'm saying is, you know, we've been pretty good as shopkeepers over the years. Napoleon's, you know, sneeringly described us as a country of shopkeepers. And I wish we were doing better and not having to face the staunch competition and seemingly getting beaten by a business from overseas. It's the same with everything. After the Second World War, when the car industry in this country ran down to nothing, so all of a sudden Japan and Germany moved their operations into Europe and we were suddenly buying Japanese and German cars. That's the free market and I'm all in support of it. Now, Miss Jones, of course, we can't go through a Planet Porky podcast without talking about something Beatle. And there have been, in the last couple of weeks, there have been two anniversaries. One, a very, very joyous anniversary, and that is the release of Hey Jude, okay, which was, I think, the greatest Beatles record as a group, if you see what I mean. But unfortunately, not the same year, the year before, 1967, very close to the death of Brian Epstein. The Brian Epstein story has never really been told, has it?
Well, yeah, it has. He did write his own memoir. There have been films, there have been television documentaries. Yeah. I think most of us know the Brian Epstein story. Interestingly, this week, or should I say the end of last week, a new statue has been unveiled in Liverpool, which is a nice little statue of Brian looking as though he's walking down the road.
Oh.
It's just kind of embedded in the pavement.
Yeah.
And it's a good likeness as well. Mm. People tend to believe that he killed himself. He was always a troubled soul because he was a closet gay.
Yeah.
He probably didn't take his own life intentionally. He was using a lot of drugs and it seemed to me as though it was an accidental overdose.
Yeah.
But the Beatles did begin to lose their way after he died because they were still very young.
Yeah.
They depended on him for all the sometimes very ill-advised business decisions,
yeah,
but he made them. Mm. After he went, there was no one to guide them. They were growing up. They were heading in different directions and they started to disintegrate.
Yeah, no, no.
But Hey Jude, it's distinguished because it was a non-album single.
Oh.
It was written by Paul McCartney. It was the first release, I don't know if you know, on their new Apple record label.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And it was a number one hit in many, many countries and it was the top seller single in this country that year.
Yeah.
And it evolved, maybe you know this, from a little ballad type song that Paul wrote for Julian Lennon,
right,
after his dad,
absolutely,
left his mum for Yoko Ono.
Yeah, absolutely. I never quite got that because Jude and Jules is different. But anyway, look, I accept that that's the case.
Well, it's quite similar, isn't it?
Hey,
Jules.
It is. On the Brian Epstein thing, you're right. But my reading of that is that Sgt. Pepper's had come out in 67. And at that stage, Brian Epstein was superfluous to the Beatles. He was only any good when they were on the road. He was organising the tours. He was setting up Shea Stadium and Candlestick Park and all that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden, they were totally under the control of George Martin and the engineers at Abbey Road. And I think he felt pushed out. Just for the benefit of our millions of listeners, by the way, to those much younger than me, Brian Epstein was the manager of the Beatles. He ran a furniture shop in Liverpool and he wondered what the fuss was down at the Cavern every lunchtime, went down, saw the Beatles and realised he'd hit on gold, signed them up and the rest.
Well, his family ran the furniture shop and he had a division of it,
yep,
which was a record shop and selling musical instruments as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah,
he'd never managed anybody before in his life.
No,
so they were finding their way together,
yeah,
really. Mm. But he was a very straight, up and down, a sort of classic, even you might say a Jacob Rees-Mogg type character.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
Very staid and,
yeah,
and seemed older than he really was, and
mm,
so on. And he was enchanted by these gabby, had the gift of the gab,
yeah,
didn't they?
Yeah.
Talented boys with that Liverpool sort of attitude.
Absolutely.
And musical talent. And it took him, because he was a failed, frustrated actor,
mm,
himself,
mm,
and it took him into a world of glitz and glamour that he couldn't access otherwise.
Yeah.
But yes, he became superfluous after they came off the road,
mm,
because Brian was never involved in the creative process.
Yeah, yeah.
That was all, as you say, George Martin's,
yeah,
terrain.
No, I totally agree. Just talking about the world of pop music, music, by the way. I came across a very funny story. Nobody who's listening to this will remember who a guy called PJ Proby was. I don't know if you do, Miss Jones. I think you.
Well, I do. I mean, it was a little earlier than my time, but I do remember he became famous because he split his trousers on stage and got arrested.
That's right. But the story's better than what I read. I don't know where it came from. It came from somebody's book. But anyway, this guy Proby was American, and you're absolutely right. He was on stage somewhere, and he was backing up Cilla Black. Okay, or it was on the same bill as Cilla Black. And you're quite right, his trousers were so tight that when he hit a high note, his trousers split down the back and, you know, revealed his underwear, so to speak. And you're right, he got arrested. But what I didn't realise was there was a bloke waiting in the wings who was the relief singer should anything go wrong, you know, somebody taken ill or somebody attacked by a member of the crowd or something like that. And that was Tom Jones. And that's how Tom Jones's career started. Tom Jones says, I was on tour with Cilla Black and It's Not Unusual had just been released, but nobody had ever heard of me, okay? And he says, the guy who co-headlined was, in fact, the very man, PJ Proby. And after he bust his pants, as Tom Jones puts it.
There's a euphemism.
He bust his pants. He was kicked off the tour. So I took his place and the rest is history. I mean, honestly, we've all had lucky breaks in life, haven't we? And strange things have happened. And, you know, I don't know, particularly in politics, you know, sadly, John Smith, who was leader of the Labour Party, died when they probably would have won the next election. And a man called Tony Blair took over. And of course, you know, again, that's history. But, you know, fate can deal a funny hand sometimes.
Well, yeah, a publishing editor of mine, lovely man called Alan Samson, famously said years ago, every great story starts with the zip breaking. And I think that's true. Oh. But the interesting thing about PJ Proby is that nobody ever remembers any of his songs.
That's right, I can't. You're absolutely
and
right.
I think that in 1967, which was obviously before our time, he had a hit called Nicky Hokey. And I think none of us has ever even heard it.
Neither have I. I thought he did that one. It's over. It's over. I don't even know what it's called, but I just remember the chorus. It's over. But look.
No, that was, oh my goodness. Oh, no.
The Something Brothers or something? Or
No. That was a friend of mine does a tribute act to him.
It's over.
That was Roy Orbison.
Oh, is that Roy Orbison? Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It is, yeah. Yeah, I love Roy Orbison. I think he's great.
Yeah, I was just thinking of my friend Dave Collison, who does a brilliant tribute to Roy Orbison.
Right.
And he also performs in a band called the Trembling Wilburys, which is obviously a tribute act to the Trembling Wilburys, the super group.
Yeah.
And they're performing on Sunday night, and I shall be down there to see them.
Yeah, well, excellent. Where's that then?
At the Half Moon Putney, the famous Half Moon Putney.
Half Moon Putney, yeah, very good indeed. Excellent, well done. Listen, there's another book out on Agatha Christie. I get fed up with reading books on Agatha Christie, but every time I do, there's something new in it. I mean, there still seems to be a fascination with the fact that Agatha Christie went missing for 5 days, when in fact she got a bit depressed because her husband was seeing another woman and she was found in a hotel in Yorkshire. So I think that's the most over-egged story in the world of literature.
Well, obviously she just took off for a few days because she was pissed off that her husband was shagging someone else.
Yes, that's about it.
You know, how many of us have done that, ladies? It's not such a big story, is it?
Yeah, well, that's all right.
Maybe it was because she was Agatha Christie. I don't know. Have you ever read one of her novels?
Yes. I read the one that used to have the N-word in it, but, you know, obviously it's changed.
Yeah.
And that was about 10 people on an island, and one by one, they were all bumped off, and the fewer left, the more sort of, obviously, the finger of suspicion was pointed at one or the other. And I thought it was great. And then I thought, if all her books are as good as this, it's going to be great. I never, ever got more than the first or second chapter on any other Agatha Christie book.
I haven't completely read any of her books. I find her writing style rather archaic, which it is. I much prefer a Scottish crime writer called Val McDermid, who's one of these writers who's been accused of ripping off Agatha Christie's plots and so on. I find Val's writing much pacier, much grittier, much more accessible. Yeah. If you're writing about crime, I mean, yes, these Agatha Christie are historical stories, aren't they? If I'm reading about crime, I want to read something contemporary.
Yeah, no, you may well be right about that. That lady you've talked about, there was a row going on a couple of weeks ago about who could call themselves the Queen of Crime. It was either that lady Val or Agatha Christie. I think Agatha Christie has to hold that. The other thing I've never done, and I've always vowed I would, I'm not a great theatre girl, okay? I get restless during theatre productions if I don't...
I know. I've been in a theatre with you. It was a film, actually, wasn't it? Yeah. You could not sit still for more than 20 minutes, and we crept out early and went and had a drink.
Yeah, we did. You're absolutely right. But it was a premiere, not a romantic night out with you and I, Miss Jones.
Just to make clear to our millions of listeners.
Just for the benefit of our audience. But no, so I thought, you know, I keep reading that the mousetrap's been going now for like 57 years on broken.
I've 70-something years and I've never seen it.
Is it? No, neither have I.
I've never seen it. And there's a kind of conspiracy of silence about the plot and what, you know, kind of whodunit. Yeah. Type of thing. So people who all go and see it never tell anybody else what happened, so that if we do eventually make it, that we will not be anticipating, you know, the thing that happens. Yeah. But it's on my bucket list. I will see it before I die.
Got to see The Mousetrap. I totally agree with you. Okay, folks, I want to tell you about a fantastic experience that is now available to all. And it's brought to you by Harry's, the super sharp razor company that also gives you much, much more. You can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for delivery. In your trial pack, you get the unique engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover if you're on the move. Plus, a free hydrating spray of night lotion, okay? Absolutely everything you need for a smooth shave. Now then, your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that lets you know you're in for something special the minute you set eyes on it. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink. And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively invigorated and looking healthier. Now, let me tell you, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free. Absolutely nothing to cause concern. Everything is crafted by the experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is the £3.95 for delivery. So just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. Okay, folks, let me give you that once again, and don't delay. That's harrys.com/porky. Right, okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for listening again to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, rock chick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Now, Leslie Ann, you've got to explain something to me. I read a piece by a guy called Carl Cox, and he's described as Super DJ. He's age 60, and there's a picture of him, and, you know, he, with the greatest respect to Mr. Cox, he's no oil painting, so to speak, in terms of his age and all that.
How very rude.
Well, you know, I will hold my hands up and say, I'm no oil painting either, you know. But he's a man of some means, of wealth and success, and you know, is lauded around the world as one of the best in his business. But I have never understood how you can have super DJs. DJs, as far as I'm concerned, take a plastic vinyl record and put it on a turntable and then lift a needle and put the needle on the record. That's the job of a DJ. I mean, it's not like, you know, being Noel Gallagher and spending, you know, weeks writing songs and putting LPs together and beautifully playing, you know, a guitar. I just don't get how they're... You know, the other guy, Fatboy Slim, who was used to be married to Zoe Ball, right? I mean, I know for a fact he made tons of money because he was once the sponsor of his local football club, Brighton and Hove Albion. And I think I read he'd given them £8 million. I mean, how do these guys make all this dosh?
Your naivety is so touching, Michael. Yeah. I think, you know, the term DJ is misleading because these days it means two distinctive things. Yeah. So you've got disc jockeys who are generally more well-known as presenters, yep, nowadays, who work on radio stations, who do put shows together and they play music, yeah, and they chat and so on. You've got the other kind who traditionally used to do, say, a disco at your local church hall, yep, or a travelling disco, or, you know, they'd rock up and do events and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But those kind of disc jockeys evolved into producers. Mm-hmm. So you've got people like Mark Ronson who work with artists like Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
And they incorporate parts of other people's recorded music, mm-hmm, and they develop a new sound that they become famous for. So you've got two distinct categories.
Yeah.
But it's much more than that. Talking about the radio disc jockeys, they have traditionally been very valuable to producers, record companies and artists because they can break records, i.e. make them into hits.
Yep.
And the personality and the profile of a show, a DJ show, gains them an enormous following that can then be deployed to the good of other things.
Mm.
So they become very powerful in their ability to create hits.
Mm. Yeah,
and
yeah,
that is why they earn so much money.
Yeah, blimey, absolutely amazing. I should have gone into that when I was younger. I'd have been a great DJ because
we both should, yeah.
I have got the gift of the gab, you know, and I could have entertained people, especially with a few drinks inside me. But there we are. Listen, the other day I was talking to a mate of mine who runs a kind of one of these shops that mends your shoes and cuts your keys and all that kind of stuff. You know what I mean?
What are they called?
Simpsons, I think, is the national chain. But his is like that. But it's
other brands are available.
Yeah, that's right. And he sells like little miniature, you know, trophies, you know, which people give out to.
What would you call that shop that does all those things?
Haberdashery? No, no.
No, that's fabrics and trimmings and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, whatever it is anyway. But anyway, look, he works terribly hard to keep it going. He's open about 12 hours a day, you know what I mean? Opens for 6 hours on a Sunday. And that's where I saw him, actually, in the pub on Sunday after he'd just closed up, you know, and I was just talking to him. But the one problem he's got is, like a lot of people in the retail trade, is trying to get the right number of staff. But the biggest problem he's got is every year at about this time when the schools go back, okay, kids would come in and ask for a Saturday job. They'd finished their O-levels and they had 2 years then to do their A-levels. And he always had a queue of kids coming in wanting to work on Saturdays. He hasn't had that now for 2 years. He cannot find or recruit 16-year-olds to come and work in his shop on a Saturday. And I think that's a terrible shame because I loved my spare jobs, you know, around my schoolwork and all that kind of stuff. And do you remember a couple of weeks ago, there was a story about one of the Queen's granddaughters working in a, a place where you go and buy all your plants and things. What's it called?
A garden centre.
Yeah, there was a story about...
That was Lady Louise, Prince Edward's daughter.
And I remember reading that then and thinking, that's great, admired her and all that. But then my mate told me you just can't get them these days. Did you have a lot of Saturday jobs?
I did. My first job I had when I was 15, I used to work at a local hairdresser's, sweeping up cut hair.
Oh, I bet that was awful.
No, it wasn't. It was fun. Shampooing the ladies, and they always gave us great tips and presents at Christmas and all that.
Wow.
And then I worked at Marks and Spencer in Bromley. I worked in the food department. That was enormous fun.
Yeah.
We used to lock each other in the freezer compartments and all that.
Oh, yeah,
kind
that's
of stuff.
Great fun. Always, and then you go home and forget to let them out, and all the your friends throw.
It was very good fun. They always gave us a cruise on the Thames during the summer months. We had a big Christmas party. We had concessions like our hairdressing was paid for. We had a chiropodist, that kind of thing. And we got really well paid. And I had a job in a pub as a barmaid. And then I went into my first internship at Capital Radio after I left college. But I can tell you the reason why Saturday jobs have disappeared. Because a few years ago, they were all snapped up by pensioners needing to top up their state pensions. So all the supermarkets are suddenly, instead of employing kids still at school or students late in the evenings or weekends, they're keeping the pensioners going who are doing hours for them during the week. And the Saturday job market for kids almost vanished overnight. Now, my son Henry, who was on a scholarship when he was at Arts Ed in Chiswick, doing his musical theatre degree, he had lots of jobs. He worked behind the bar in the college when they had shows. He worked for an estate agent showing people around houses on Saturdays and sometimes in the evenings. And he also worked as a nanny, or a manny, as they used to call them. But my two girls, who were both at Exeter University, could not get Saturday jobs to save their lives. There just weren't any because all the shops were staffed by older people.
That's going to happen increasingly now. Older people now are so worried about, you know, the cost of energy and how far will the pension go and all that. Loads more people. I noticed last time I was in B&Q, by the way, a lot of very elderly sort of assistants, you know?
I know, and they shuffle around and they push those enormous trolleys. Some of them seem to be holding onto the trolleys for dear life.
Yes, they do.
And I feel very sorry for them. You know, why are these poor people who've worked all their lives having to do this even now?
Well, you say that, but I think sometimes work is very beneficial to elder people. My mum went downhill very rapidly after she had to stop working. I mean, she was a very valued shop assistant in Debenhams in Bournemouth, right, which is closed down now, like a lot of Debenham stores. But she was, you know, so appreciated, they let her work until she was 72. She'd been a widow for many years. My dad died before she was 50. So she'd been a widow for many years. And her job was her life, honestly, part-time, 4 hours a day, 4 days a week, I think, or something like that, you know. But, you know, every time a birthday came after the age of 60, you know, you had to go and see somebody and say you'd like to stay on another year. And she got that for 12 years. But then at 72, they said, I'm sorry, Joan. And honestly, it broke her heart. And she went down, you know, she went downhill very rapidly after that. So I think in many ways, working into your old age, particularly if you're a single person, can be beneficial. But getting back to the original about the Saturday job, you're absolutely right. I had a Saturday job for years. In fact, I always wanted a job. It didn't matter what I was doing. Got my first job when I was at school as a newspaper boy, and I was 13. And I used to do that in the mornings and on Friday afternoons to deliver the Chester Chronicle and the Cheshire Observer. And on Saturdays, you know, when I got a bit older, I'd go and work in a petrol station. I loved that. I loved working in a petrol station because people would come in, you know, big flash cars and all that kind of stuff. And it gave me a, you know, a huge desire to one day earn enough money to buy a big flash car, a Jaguar or something like that.
And did you used to wash the windscreen for a little tip and do all that?
No.
I used to love it when they did that.
No. We never had that. And then one day, an American drove in a hired car and asked me to wash the screen and top up the water. And, of course, I didn't know what he was talking about. So I went and found this oily old rag and rinsed it on.
How dare you talk about your boss like that?
Excuse me, Miss Jones. Honest to God, I don't know. And I rinsed it under the tap and then I went out and then instead of washing his windshield, which, you know,
was it a euphemism?
Instead of washing the windshield, I actually smeared the windshield so badly with grease you couldn't see through it. You know, and this guy was mystified as to why I'd sort of, you know.
Well, his windscreen was mystified.
But honestly, and then, you know, the boss had to come out and apologise and boil a kettle of water. And
oh, God. And then you tipped that over it and cracked it.
Well, I don't know, but. So, I got it. But no, I always had either Saturday jobs or before school jobs or after work jobs. I remember working in a fish and chip shop once, and I used to get holiday jobs as well when I was at school. The worst holiday job I had was I was a flag marker for a company that sprayed crops with helicopters, okay? And what I had to do was I had to stand in the field with an orange flag, and that was a guider for the helicopter that came in. The problem was I got absolutely covered in all the spray. It was a bit like Vietnam, you know, when a load of a load of American soldiers died because the Americans sprayed Agent Orange over the jungle to try and clear it so that the Viet Cong wouldn't have any cover to attack the Americans. But, I mean, God knows what that could have done to my health. I was spraying it. It went in my hair, it went on my face, you feel it in your throat and all that kind of stuff. And then I didn't have time to think about it. Once the helicopter flew over me, I then had to run exactly 100 paces down the field so that when the helicopter had flown over me, gone up, banked and came back, it knew where its right wing would go in the next run to spray, and then I got sprayed again.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I tell you, on the subject of Saturday jobs,
yes,
the best Saturday jobs I ever heard of were by our old friend Mr. Roger Tavener.
Oh, yes.
Who lived in the West Country, and when he was a schoolboy, he had Saturday and holiday jobs being a peat cutter and a Stilton stubber.
A Stilton stubber, right.
Isn't that just brilliant?
Oh, a peat cutter, cut peat out the ground, I suppose.
Yeah, so you cut it in sort of bricks, and they would be dried over on the side until they were sort of crispy, if you like, and then you put them on the fire, and apparently they smell really lovely. They sort of generate this gorgeous scent of kind of fields and oldness and all that. Stilton stubber, they had these gigantic copper like skewers, like you would put on a barbecue, but massive great things, like broom handles.
Sure.
And you would stab the huge Stilton wheels of cheese. And by putting the copper into the cheese, that's what causes the blue veins to appear in the cheese. So I thought this would be brilliant. If like in the old days, we used to put in our passports our occupation. Do you remember that? Way, way back, you used to put what you did for a living.
Did you?
If you had peat cutter and Stilton stubber in your passport, isn't that just brilliant?
It would be absolutely fantastic indeed, yes. And, of course, Mr. Tavener went on to much greater things, but there we are. Now, this is the first podcast we've done, Miss Jones, since Mikhail Gorbachev died, okay? I think it was the day after last week's podcast came out. So, and a highly controversial figure, but really a pivotal figure in the way that the 20th century unfolded, because, of course, he ended the Cold War. He ended the Cold War, but the problem was, at the same time, it meant the disintegration of the Soviet Union. And the reason we've got the war today in Ukraine, you know, the tyrant Putin has invaded, wants Ukraine back, is because of Mr. Gorbachev letting it go in the first place. I mean, that sounds very simplistic, but it's absolutely true. Putin wants to rebuild the Soviet Union as one of the world's great powers, a great superpower, and it literally disintegrated when the Berlin Wall came down and communism was basically dumped by the whole of the Soviet Union and all the satellites, you know, like the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, and countries like Poland and Hungary and East Germany in particular, which had been under the yoke of communist rule, became free. But now the battle is on to stay free. And honestly, now my own personal story about Russia is that even before the wall came down, it was obvious things were going to change. Mr. Gorbachev introduced perestroika, which meant more explanation, and glasnost, which meant
openness,
absolutely, and discussing freedom and all that kind of stuff. Now, at that point, we thought it's all. Funny enough, this was an initiative from Nick Lloyd, Sir Nicholas Lloyd, who was the editor of the Express, very far-seeing. He thought it's all going to happen in Russia now. Let's see if we can get somebody in there. So I went with Peter Hitchens. Peter Hitchens, of course, of great literary fame. I don't know if it's literary, but he writes a lot of columns and...
he writes a lot,
He writes an awful lot, and he writes an awful lot of sense and got a terrific insight. So Peter and I went to Russia, went to Moscow, and Peter went back on several trips, and we eventually bought two council flats from the mayor of Moscow. A group of builders came from Finland, knocked them into one, brought a load of equipment, computers and all that. We set up a bureau in Moscow. And that was before the wall came down. That was in Soviet Russia. And it was an amazing experience to live in Russia prior to the disintegration of the Soviet Union. A fantastic experience. I've probably been back to Russia a dozen times since. I'm still fascinated with the country. But, of course, communism, which had a purity about it in many ways, has been replaced in Russia with gangsterism. It is a gangster state, believe me. It's run with Putin at the top, and then everybody else who tumbles down the ranks is a gangster in one way or the other, either a political gangster or a business gangster. And the oligarchs robbed the country of hundreds of billions of pounds, and the result is what you see today.
Two things stood out in the coverage of Mikhail Gorbachev's passing.
Yeah.
And one was the insistence that he remained a communist.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, how could he have done when his wife, Raisa, yeah, who predeceased him by some years,
yes,
was bobbing about the world dressed in Dior and sporting a Chanel handbag?
She was.
He was the symbol of the beginning of the end of the Cold War.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem to sit well with me, that at all.
Well,
interesting.
He actually said to Mrs. Thatcher once, "I'm not even sure I'm a communist anymore." And that's when we got the first hint that things were going to change.
Yes, but, since his death, the attitude throughout Russia is good riddance, whereas we in the West have revered him for having changed history. And now, of course, we have the tragedy of history looking as though it's going to be changed back.
Yes, we do. I mean, there's two views of communism, and this is always expressed to me when I've been to Russia, and I haven't been there now for probably 5 years or something like that. But one view is, we wish we were back under the communist rule, because we had a home, we had heating, we had food, we had a job, and we had a stable society in which we lived. Whereas now, allegedly a free country, it's certainly a capitalist country, lots of people make money there, but a lot of people now are living in the gutter, swigging vodka every day. And those who did well out of the fall of the Berlin Wall love the freedom, but tens of millions didn't. Tens of millions found that the safety that the state provided for them has gone. And that, I think, is just about sums up the argument for and against communism, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely does. It's a tragedy.
Yeah.
But history has kind of imploded, fallen in on itself.
Has.
And
yes,
I wonder how much longer this dreadful scenario in Ukraine will continue.
We don't know. We just know that nothing seems to happen, does it, on a day-by-day basis. It looks like, to me, it's all sort of now, I don't know, become an impossible situation to resolve because neither side wants to sort of give anything.
Concede, yeah.
Do you ever remember a group, Miss Jones, called Creedence Clearwater Revival?
I do know. Yeah, I know who they are. Yeah. Go on. I know you're going to sing it to me.
Yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, I see a bad moon rising. I see trouble on the way. Now, they were a great group. When I was at school, the King's School, Chester, there was one lad there who was a Creedence Clearwater Revival nut and he used to bring all their LPs in. We put it on the record player. I thought the songs were fantastic. And they did Bad Moon Rising and they did, what was another one they did?
Because they came from sort of San Francisco, but they posed as kind of Southern country rockers.
Yeah, they did.
They played as though they emerged from the Mississippi Delta,
right,
and did all those sort of early blues. I have an interesting factoid about them, actually. They posed one time as an old style jug band. Do you know what a jug band
is? Yeah, I do. Yeah, from the Deep South. Yeah.
They literally used to play a glass jug or a stoneware jug. Mm. You played it with your lips like a trombone. So it was known as a jug band.
Yeah.
It was kind of like the early skiffle bands, but skiffle bands didn't have a jug in them. And they did an album, Creedence Clearwater Revival. I think it was their fourth studio album, 1969, called Willie and the Poor Boys. Willie and the Poor Boys was picked up by Bill Wyman, the bass player of the Rolling Stones.
Right.
And he stole it and used it as the title of a project he was working on in 1985, which was a film and an album. And it was a sort of an alter ego band, if you like, called Willie and the Poor Boys.
Right.
And it was a super group with lots of people like Eric Clapton and Kenny Jones playing in it.
Yeah.
And this was to raise money for ARMS, which was Action Research for Multiple Sclerosis,
right,
which their friend Ronnie Lane very sick with.
Yeah,
and so Willie and the Poor Boys actually derived from the Creedence album,
amazing,
which I always thought was fascinating.
Amazing. You've just reminded me of their other great hit, because you said from the South, from the Mississippi, Proud Mary, keeps on rolling. Proud Mary keeps on rolling, da 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 da, da rolling. And Proud Mary was a Mississippi showboat, you know, with a...
Just one of those steamers, right. Yeah. I think most of us who came a little afterwards remember the Tina Turner version of that hit.
Right, yeah, we do. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Which was so energetic, so amazing. Right. Tina in her pomp, yeah. But they did songs like Cotton Fields and Born in the Bayou and that kind of thing, which sort of gave lie to the fact of where they came from. I was quite fascinated to discover that it was John Fogerty and his brother Tom who kind of started the band, and they started out as the Blue Velvets, but then they changed their name, Oh Dear, Oh Dear, to the Gollywogs.
Oh God.
I mean, you can't even say that word nowadays, can you?
No, I
just did. But they became Creedence Clearwater Revival in 1967.
Right, but just to conclude all that, they only lasted 2.5 years. From 79 to 81, apparently. No, from 69 to 71, apparently. And that's...
All the usual old lawsuits and court battles and fallouts. Yeah. And John Fogerty carried on as a solo artist, and he did perform their songs.
Yeah.
And they're still, because they're still really well known, especially in America, because they're played all over American classic rock radio.
That's right, absolutely. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another edition of, what were we doing then?
What are we called? Who are we? What's my name?
Life on Planet Paul.
Oh, yeah.
And Miss Jones, thank you very much. Can I just say to the audience, today's podcast is in association with Harry's. And we'll be back with you next week. I get restless during theatre productions if I don't...
I know. I've been in a theatre with you.
Oh, right, okay.
It was a film, actually, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You could not sit still for more than 20 minutes, and we crept out early and went and had a drink.
Yeah, we did. You're absolutely right. But it was a premiere, not a romantic night out with you and I, Miss Jones.
Just to make clear to our millions of listeners.
Just for the benefit of our audience.
Did you used to wash the windscreen for a little tip and do all that?
No.
I used to love it when they did that.
No, we never had that. And then one day, an American drove in a hired car and asked me to wash the screen and top up the water. And of course, I didn't know what he was talking about. So I went and found this oily old rag and rinsed it on.
How dare you talk about your boss like that?
No, excuse me, Miss Jones, honest to God, I don't know. And I rinsed it under the tap, and then I went out, and then instead of washing his windshield, which, you know...
Was it a euphemism?
Instead of washing the windshield, I actually smeared the windshield so badly with grease, you couldn't see through it, you know. And this guy was mystified as to why I'd sort of, you know...
Well, his windscreen was mystified.
It was, yeah.
House dust mites breed absolutely everywhere, including in your eyelashes.
Good God.